cataractcoach.com. Podcast number 25 with Christos Ifantidis. Christos is a young ophthalmologist, specializing in anterior segment surgery. He was formerly at the University of Colorado in Denver, where he taught residents and led a very large program to provide care to thousands of patients. He since left that position and switched to private practice in Florida. What were the reasons behind that? What was the transition like? How does he compare the academic world to the private practice world? And can you continue doing research and innovating if you're in the private practice world? Is it any different compared to the academic world? He shares all the great information. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today we have Dr. Christos Ifantidis, who's an ophthalmologist specializing in cornea, cataract, anterior segment surgery, and has experience in both the academic world and the private practice world. He's a newer name in the last few years that you see more and more on the podium, more and more in the print journals, and you've even seen his videos on Cataract Coach with the rotary chop, which we'll talk about too. So Christos, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Uday. It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. It's an honor.
Tell our audience here, which is typically younger, probably age 30 to 50 is our audience, and almost all ophthalmologists, what was your path in ophthalmology?
That's a great question, and you're right. I mean, I remember starting to listen to Cataract Coach when I was in training. So for all the young folks out there, I think you're doing the right thing by tuning in to this wonderful resource. You know, I actually didn't think I was going to do ophthalmology until the very end of my third year of medical school. I was really totally gung-ho about vascular surgery. I had worked in a vascular surgery lab. I love vascular biology. And then a person who worked in my lab decided to become an ophthalmologist. Darren Goldman is his name. I still owe him credit for steering me in the right path. But he said, just try this elective. You don't have, it's not mandated. Nobody really knows about ophthalmology. Just try it out. And I instantly fell in love. I mean, the surgeries were elegant. The eye is an organ that's like a sentinel organ that tells us diseases all over the body. And so I totally switched my plans. It was nuts. So I, embarrassingly, so
this,
I'm on.
This Darren Goldman, is this a retina specialist in Florida?
Yeah.
He was my resident.
Oh, that's right.
I used to hold his hands. Right. He's an amazing person.
I love him. Yeah.
What so a small world.
Yeah, that is a small world. That's right. He went to UCLA. That's great. He was a really big force in that decision. The surgeries were amazing. I went on to do ophthalmology residency. And for me, I think a lot, there are different parts of the eye. The vascular biology really clicked with retina and pediatrics in terms of ROP. I think for me, doing the refractive improvements for an eye, seeing that amount of reversible blindness we can do on a global scale from something as simple as a cataract surgery, it drove me to really focus on the front of the eye. And so that's where my passion was. I did my residency at Mount Sinai. I got to travel to different hospital systems in the Bronx, the VA hospital, Queens at Elmhurst Hospital, which is, you know, more languages spoken in that zip code than anywhere else in the world. It really developed my appreciation for all of the eye diseases that we see all over the world. I went on to do a global ophthalmology fellowship with Brad Feldman and learn a lot of anterior segment skills during that fellowship. Then I landed an academic job, like you mentioned, at the University of Colorado in Denver Health specifically, which is a safety net hospital.
Tell us about your experience there. So that's a safety net hospital. You worked hard. You saw some really advanced disease.
Yeah. It, just like Elmhurst, this place was, I think 214 languages spoken there on the translator line, you know, half the time. People coming in with all sorts of crazy pathology, trauma. The hospital itself is, a book was written about it called The Knife and Gun Club, and tells you a little bit about it. But it was the first hospital in Colorado, actually, before Colorado even became a state. It was a frontier hospital, Denver General, it used to be called. So it's got a pretty illustrious history of having, I like to joke about it, having a higher rate of people minding their own business. So a lot of trauma there that you see,
Sure.
whether it's motor vehicle or violence. So got a lot of exposure. I feel like I gathered, the skills that it would have taken 10 years, and just a few. So that was a really big learning experience, both from understanding really advanced disease, but also just how organized institutional medicine works, the pros and cons of each of one of those things too.
Well, and you get to work with residents as well.
You tons. So, it's one of the things I miss now.
Sure.
I still talk to my old residents. I see what they're up to. We stay in touch. I'm just excited to see all the great things that they're doing now. But as you know, because you did something similar at the safety net hospitals, that's where a lot of the learning is happening.
Right.
At the academic institution, typically at the institute, you're just shadowing. At these types of hospitals that we worked at, you end up having the residents develop their style of practice. And
Right.
so being a small part of that in their style of practice is a real honor. It's for me it was really critical. I think about all the people who taught me and how my techniques are a conglomeration of all my teachers, and
Right.
to know that I could be a part of somebody's style too is a real treat.
Yeah, it's neat when you're doing your training, when you're learning, whether it's in your residency fellowship or even your first few years of practice, you tend to like absorb other people's techniques and kind of amalgamate them all together into your own style. And then you evolve your own style. But it's really nice to have that exposure to a wide variety of mentors and surgical styles and techniques. That's really very valuable.
Yeah, and you learn that somebody might say, "Oh, you can't do that," but then whether you go on cataractcoach.com or there's another attendee that says,
Yeah.
"Watch this, you could do this," and then so there's like some problem solving. It's almost like being a kid again, right? Where somebody tells you
Right.
can do something, somebody tells you can't do something, and you really have to think through, well, can I do this? Should I not do it? And so it's really constructive and a really creative time, and both for the residents and fellows, but also for the attendings, right? I think you have to be really patient and good to teach, because you could be a great surgeon, but it doesn't mean you're a great teacher.
Right. And the nice thing too with those county type facilities is that you can do things that you may not be able to do otherwise in private practice. So a case comes to mind when I was attending residence a few years ago. Patient came in with some trauma, had a terrible traumatic cataract, damaged iris, large ankle, sensory XT, and ptosis. And so we did obviously the cataract, fixated the IOL appropriately with whatever measures. Did a pupilloplasty, did an RNR for the strabismus, and did a mutorectomy for the ptosis, one sitting.
That's crazy. Yeah, that would have, I think you would have angered a lot of people at a private surgical center if you
Right.
tried doing that
Well,
there.
I wouldn't do it in Beverly Hills now. I'd fix the traumatic cataract, to fix the iris and all that, but I then send them to an oculoplastics person for the eyelid or a strabismus person for the XT. But like in our county hospital, we didn't have any fellows other than one retina fellow, and who came only one day a week. So the residents there, you learned by just doing. And it was really neat.
It's so hands-on. Whether you're on, they're on call or they're in the OR and clinic with you, they're really developing that style, really feeling like they're the doctors in charge. And that comes
For
with
sure.
great responsibility too. I think it teaches them that some ownership over patients.
What were some of the challenges there, working with the residents, the county hospital? Were you able to overcome any challenges?
Oh yeah, I think when there are young attendings that come in, they're always energized, and
Sure.
so I had there were some retiring physicians, so trying to jazz up some of the stuff was a little bit slower than I had hoped. But I think with the, when other attendings, Kira Capitina-Young joined, I believe, a year after me, and then others followed, Miriam Ahmed and so on and so forth, Jesse Smith, a young group, I think really totally changed the experience for the residency for the better in terms of just having fresh eyes on a system. I think there was some stuff that were really well established and excellent from all the other folks, but then being able to say, no, we're willing to do more cases per day, don't worry, like we'll stay late, or just being a little bit tougher on the residents on some stuff. It's less laissez-faire about some of the ways clinic was run. So we made a lot of improvements. There's some stuff that you hit an invisible resistance in these institutions where you want to do the right thing. One instance is highlighting, we did this huge program looking at the finances of OR cancellations because we were getting sometimes like 30% cancellations, no shows. Couldn't refill the spots, that sort of thing. We highlight how many millions of dollars are lost per year just for eye cases, come up with solutions, and it just doesn't really go anywhere for one reason or another. In private practice, they'd say, oh my God, we're hemorrhaging money. How do we get, transportation for the patients, extra care, whatever? At institutions, you have to go through multiple committee meetings with people who don't do ophthalmology, who are worried about other services too. And quite frankly, I think they're worried about getting promoted. And it's almost like corporate culture too, where I'll be here for the next 2 years, and then I'm going to jump to something else to keep going up the ladder. In private practice, it doesn't really work that way as much. So saying, hey, we're losing millions of dollars a year, that ears perk up, and it just magically gets done. Institutions, it doesn't really work that way. So there are some frustrating things that way, because it all translates into patient care, right? If we're losing 30% of those slots, it just means people are waiting longer to get their surgeries,
Of course.
and we're sort of spinning our wheels. So figuring out how we can help patients get to surgery, oh, they missed their ride, this, that, and the other. Those were some of the frustrations that everybody in institutional medicine has to deal with.
I think you're right. I think one of the things for me was I love the patients, love the nurses, love the residents, but some of the bureaucracy and the administrative grief is a little bit too much to deal with. But I do like one point you made, which is bring in young blood. And I think that's an important thing. I did at this county hospital, the residents, basically all my 30s and all my 40s, and I retired at 52 from it. And I think that brought a great energy to build upon what the previous people did. And I applaud them for the work they did, but try to take it to the next level. And I think now passing the baton on to someone younger than me, significantly younger, to take it to the next level, I think that's the right move, as opposed to me sitting there for another 20 years doing the same thing. So I think bringing that fresh blood in is great.
You're so right. I mean, I wouldn't call it burnout as much as just focusing on the different things that you want to focus on. And when you're young and motivated, you can really put a lot of energy into different projects. And I'm just excited to see the new attendings that are there now and some of the old ones that are still there. Just really, I think, create a premier training place for residents. So, little plug for the University of Colorado for any medical students looking to apply. But I think you'll be hard pressed to find better training anywhere in the world.
Oh, for sure. In fact, two of my former residents, Jameson Engel and Jamie, she went there as well. They did the cornea fellowship and absolutely loved it with Rich Davidson and
Oh
the
yeah,
other cornea
Rich is
faculty
the
heads.
man. Yeah,
Yeah,
Mike
that's a
Terradella.
right. So that's a fantastic, for sure, fantastic program. But what made you leave? Because I'm looking at you now, I don't see too many gray hair, and I'm guessing you're still kind
That's
of
just the
early to mid
pixelation,
30s.
man. That's the pixelation.
You're pretty young still, right? You're like probably early to mid 30s.
I'm actually 39.
You don't look it. You don't look it. Wow. Okay, I'll take it.
Thanks. Yeah, I look like a baby without the beard. So, it's You know, for me, one of the catalysts for that was some family health issues. My dad ended up getting gastric cancer, and we got him great care, but just thinking about something I heard about during that time period, which was, you know, if you see your parents, let's say, four times a year, and they live another 10 years, you know, they're 70, around 70 now, let's say they live to be 80, you know, four times a year, that's 40 times more before you'll never get to see them again. And that really struck a chord with me, especially since the five-year survival for gastric cancer is not great. And so I thought, you know, there's a lot more that I can do. I've got, you know, I'm pretty young in my career. Let's try out moving closer to home. And when I mean close, I mean 3 minutes from my parents is where Tyson I is.
Wow.
So
that's right. You joined Toby Tyson in over 20 years. What an amazing guy.
That's where I got really lucky, I think, from a career standpoint. Again, you know, I think University of Colorado gave me my start, and then Toby and David Stevens really created an opening for me, knowing that I had a pressing issue at home. And I could not have joined a better practice. I mean, you know, besides getting to see my family, I mean, I've seen my parents 40 times in the last 2 months, probably. You know, I get to go over their house after work. And my brothers moved back here too. So, you know, it's a big Greek family, you know how the Greeks are. So anyway, it's a practice that lets you highlight what you're good at and really run with it. And Toby is, you know, the person I want to emulate. I mean, he's still young and has accomplished so much. I mean, from innovative stuff to working with clinical trials to working with early stage, mid stage, late stage companies. He has been involved with pretty much every big innovation we've had. And he's a killer surgeon. I mean, he's an amazing surgeon, takes great care of patients. And the culture that he's built is phenomenal. I mean, the employees are smiling. The patients are always writing reviews on Google about how the employees are smiling and that they're, you know, the doctors are nice, all this stuff. It really starts with Toby. I mean, he's even keeled. He treats everybody well. He knows how to, you know, handle stressful situations. And this one, so you know the hurricane hit here.
Sure.
And it was, I mean, he's a, you know, a business owner of a big business. He ended up, you know, I remember I just got there and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I just got here and the Category 5 hurricane just hit. So we go up on the roof of the clinic and the solar panels had all blown off. And I'm thinking, this is a lot of money lost. And this is a crazy amount of damage. And I looked at him for his response and he just looked around and started laughing. And he's like, can you believe this? Look at this. And yeah, it hurt financially, but the fact that he can let things roll off of him like that.
Yeah.
Some people would have, you know, had their hands in their hair saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So that amount of being cool, calm, and collective, I think translates throughout the practice. And, you know, David is another example of that. He just became a partner this year. Amazing human as well. I knew him actually when I was a fellow at Wills. He was a resident at Wills. And so I got to interact with him there. But just really fantastic, down-to-earth folks who really want to take good care of patients and treat their employees right.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I've known Toby for 20 years. He's just a sweetheart of a guy, too.
Yeah,
obviously, a killer surgeon for sure, but more importantly, just treats from the heart. Like, you know, every patient he treats, he's going to get the same treatment as if it's his own family member.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've learned a lot from him already.
Now, I'm wondering how many times Toby's coming over to your house, though, for some great Greek food.
You know, that's a great question. We have an apartment. I should invite him over. I haven't yet, but we go out to dinner a good amount, so.
That's fantastic. So when you're in his practice, you're doing obviously anterior segment, cataract, refractive, probably MIGS. Are you doing any research projects? Are you working with any new kind of ideas or concepts in ophthalmology?
Yeah, it's been a great continuity from the research I was doing at the university. I've got a couple of my own technologies that are gaining some legs, and then just from a clinical standpoint with the clinical trials at Tyson Eye, you know, becoming a PI on a few different studies, and then working with some other companies in industry like Ace Vision Group. They are working on a presbyopic treatment with microscleroporphyration, and so it's opened. If you're willing to do extra work, you know, outside of your clinical job, people pick up on that, and you know, you get chances to show that your feedback might be valuable. And so I've been lucky enough to do that with a few different companies now.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's nice to have a hand in the future development of our field and give your input and things that you want.
Yeah, I think it's fine to just sort of let people, you know, hand you something and it's already formed, and changing it is so hard because then you have to go through the FDA process and everything. So to have a little bit of input into the development, for me personally, the trade-off is, well, it might not work the right way the first time, but the iterative process of, you know, prototypes and all these other things to me is exciting because you get to give input into the final product before it's set in stone. Because most surgeons just get something that's set in stone.
Right.
To be part of something where you are improving the safety or the efficacy, usability, that is to me one of the most exciting things. It's more exciting than speaking. It's more exciting than many other things. And so I spend extra energy on that stuff because it's personally fruitful, even if, you know, nothing comes of it product-wise. It's just understanding how the process works and knowing the difficulties. I'm keenly aware of how difficult it is for companies to create a stellar product. And right. I've only figured that out through understanding the trials and tribulations of my own projects and working with early stage companies to understand how much energy they put into something that may not even work.
That's for sure. It sounds like you have a real neat setup there. At some point in the future, you could probably start a great fellowship. Cataract refractive anterior segment fellowship, involve the young fellow in obviously a ton of surgery, but also these trials, development of products. That'd be a fantastic fellowship. Maybe your teaching days are still ahead of you.
I hope so. I've spoken to David about it. He's an energized guy about something like that. So, I think that's a great idea.
How's your patient kind of population or your let's say your surgical spectrum? How's it different now compared to what it was at the university or at the Big Denver Hospital?
Well, I thought it was going to be a lot different, but it turns out, based on the locations that I go to, it turns out that it's still pretty diverse. So I have an office that I go to that's in East Fort Myers, where it's pretty close to the agricultural area. So I get to get a lot of patients who are non-English speaking, advanced pathology, that sort of thing. But it's interesting because it abuts, the clinic is actually inside of a large private community that's really well to do. And so we get a mix of agriculture and these decently well off folks, which gives me a good wide breadth there. And then in Cape Coral, just some great, you know, all spectrum of the economic classes come through there. I actually grew up in Cape Coral, so I get to, you know, practice and take care of folks. I get to see my friends' parents now, and just did some medical school.
Awesome.
Medical school classmates, parents, surgery. So it is great to feel like I'm taking care of the community that I grew up in. But it's a wide breadth of all spectra, you know, not just, you know, the sort of Naples well-to-do. You get the whole gamut here. So that's been really nice. I still get to do a lot of the crazy cases that I did in Denver here, and yeah, it's been I'm doing like 4 times the amount of surgery as well.
Of course, yeah, for sure. A busy place. Florida is a very busy place when it comes to ophthalmology and ocular surgery, for sure. It's special to be near, in your hometown. Like, my high school is 6 miles from my clinic.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's like, I have the you same setup as you. Right. Yeah. Like, I did surgery for a patient recently, and I just recognized them. I'm like, did you live at this on this street? I'm like, yeah, is your son named this, and you have a daughter named this? Yeah, they went to school with me. I used to play with them in sixth grade.
Yeah. No, I every day I'm learning about some sort of connection that we had, you know, whether it was where my dad roasted coffee and they came in there, or our health food store or whatever. It's such a small, even in big city places, you have that small community feel that you'll, if you ask the right questions and you spend a little time talking to the people, you'll realize, you know, pretty much everybody the same.
That's awesome. So in addition to obviously doing a great practice where you're super busy surgically and seeing a lot of patients, doing a ton of procedures, you're also involved a lot in the podium speaking. I've seen you at multiple meetings now on the podium. I've really enjoyed your lectures. You've obviously submitted videos about your Rotary Chop, which we can talk about, to Cataract Coach, which I thought was very, very innovative. And I've also seen your name in a lot of the print journals. So how do you have time to fit all this in?
Well, we don't have kids yet, so that helps. but, you know, I took opportunities and reached out and asked if I could do those types of things early on. One piece of advice for young surgeons, I would say, is just offer your services for things you might want to do, and learn when you're young about what you like to do and what you don't like to do. And distributing or getting a message out is a critical component of education. If you develop a new technique and nobody uses it, you're not really helping patients. So for me, the education that comes along with publishing peer-reviewed literature, you know, the trade journal articles, speaking on different topics, what it all boils down to is getting a message out for maybe doing something better or different, or thinking about things in a different light that can push our field forward. So you have to spend the extra time doing it, even if it's not reimbursed, if you believe in that mission, which is, you know, pushing forward. Because compared to 30 years ago, you know, it's easy to look back 30 years ago and say, I can't believe they were doing that. And, you know, clearly we're better now. They were wrong. I used to ask my residents this question: in 30 years, what do you think people will look back at us and say we were doing wrong now? Most people can't say
a
single thing.
That's a great question.
Right? Like, we're thinking we're doing everything the right way, obviously, but we're obviously not. So what are we doing wrong today that in 30 years we'll realize that was how we felt about, you know, the 1990s, which is crazy to think that was 30 years ago. But, you know.
It's like when I was a resident, I saw extra caps being done, and they would teach you to do it with these corneosclerosal scissors to the left and to the right. And I was like, are you kidding? That was so barbaric. And now when you look at, even comparing apples to apples, just look at a modern form of extra cap, MSICS. What an entirely different way of making an incision.
Totally different. Sutureless. It's beautiful. It's my favorite cataract surgery. But that, you know, and it goes, it's diagnoses that we give to things that are wrong. It's the fact that, you know, our taps and our diagnosis of what causes uveitis is, like, more often than not, idiopathic, which just means we don't know what it's caused by.
Right.
So those are the types of things that it's, if you're not part of that effort, it's simple. It's the same thing. You're just waiting for somebody to give you something concrete later on. I like to be proactive about that stuff and sort of be in the fight for what, you know, is going to be the next thing we say. We were thinking about this potentially differently than we should have been. Or how about we think about this in a different light?
Okay, let's you and me brainstorm this.
Okay.
Now let's think together. This is actually, you really got my gears turning. 30 years from now, 2050, what are we going to look back and say, gosh, why would you do cataract surgery that way? Now, I can think of a couple things. One is, why do you let the bag collapse? Why do you put in these very thin lenses and let the entire capsular bag shrink wrap down? I think that's one thing. What do you think about that concept?
No, I think you're spot on. And the nice thing about that is the next generation accommodating lenses are filling the bags, right? When you look at the development of these lenses by you know, early and middle stage, I would say, companies, they are showing great results, XUS, with accommodating lenses that fill the entire bag, that get as close to nature as possible. I tell that to patients all the time. I say, you know, we're going to replace your big crystalline lens with a really thin and much narrower lens. Sometimes you see the edge of the lens, it bends the light different way. Sometimes it's a benefit, like in angle closure glaucoma, to give it its space. But you're absolutely right. That is a huge deficit that we need to fix, to say, how do we get more closer to nature, how nature intended our lenses to work?
Yeah, it also decreases PCO rates. So I was luckily involved in the LensGen Juveen trial. That's the accommodating lens from LensGen. And I did the very first human implantation. I did it in 2015 in Panama. And then I did more. Yeah, 8 years ago. And then I did more in Mexico, in Monterrey, Mexico after that. There had been zero PCO. Yeah. By keeping the bag open, zero PCO in, I don't know how many eyes, hundreds of eyes. It's very unusual.
Those are the types of jumps in technology that we haven't even realized all the benefits of. You know, we always focus on, oh, it's like accommodation, holy grail, that kind of thing. But you're right, all the things that come along with maybe it's having not as big of a deal of being exactly on target, 0.50, you know, diopters, doesn't make a difference when you have an accommodating lens.
Right.
So really exciting field, the lens development stuff, I think is, we're going to see some really killer stuff in the next probably 5 to 10 years. But
okay, so we got the lenses, we got keeping the bags open. What else should we be doing better?
Well, I know some people are naysayers. I personally think that robotic cataract surgery is going to completely shake things up. I
agree with you. And I'm involved already with a company doing it.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, for our journal clubs that I like to do with our medical students at the University of Colorado, I would purposely pick topics that were a little controversial. One was just reviewing robotic cataract surgery, and I did it year over year, and the literature is really outstanding in terms of having autonomous cataract surgery for routine cases. So,
correct.
And the way I think about things is anything that can be done step by step over and over again is easily replaced by robotics. That's just like the law of the land when you think about custom cars versus, you know, generic cars. The custom cars are harder. The generic cars are very easy. Complex cataract surgery, I think, will only be, for the next X amount of decades, maybe robot-assisted, but still need that human touch. But for a routine cataract surgery, I think we're going to be challenged by outcomes, which matters the most. If you can standardize each step over and over again, outcomes improve. So
there's zero doubt.
Yeah. Well, between us, but you talk to some folks, and it's whether it's fear or just disbelief or denial. You know, and that's a good thing for young surgeons to think about. You have to understand that something can come along, whether it's an eye drop that cures cataracts or whatever, it will change things and we'll have to pivot. And I'm less afraid about it because physicians are so inventive. We will figure out how to help. There are so many problems with the eyes. Our list of eye problems is where it is because that's all that we have our energy that we can do right now. You know,
right.
When a problem gets solved, there's so many more problems that right. need solving. We'll pivot, so we'll be fine.
Well, I'm involved with financial disclosure. I'm an investor in this company, but this company called Horizon Surgical.
Yeah, yeah.
In the LA area. Yeah, you saw that the presentation at ACOS.
Yeah.
I can tell you it's unbelievable. It's wow. It could be better than a lot of junior residents already.
I've spoken to a couple too, and I know that it is really impressive stuff.
Right. But I think you're right. It still has to be supervised, and it's essentially for your average, routine, straightforward case. That small pupil, dense rock, pseudoexfoliation, loose zonule case is not going to be done by the robot. You need a surgeon with a very high level of skill to accomplish those cases.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just because the technical computing power needed for decision-making trees like that are you know, really advanced. But there's plenty of times, I mean, I love going to hear lectures where people say, you know, I wish somebody had just told me to snap out of it at the time I was doing the surgery because I really didn't want to see the vitreous there. I kept saying it wasn't there. To have that assistance to like highlight something on the screen and say like, hey, there's a 95% chance that this is vitreous coming forward. That's good for the patient. It's good for the surgeon.
Right.
It's bad for the
our
schedule
egos.
Of that day. Yeah, maybe,
bad for our egos.
Or it could be good for our egos, right? A little ego death, not a bad thing. But you're right. It hurts. It hurts for that. But you know, we figure it out later in the surgery anyway. So if we can be safer with that type of computing power, then
right.
You know, I welcome it. I look forward to it. And the philosophy is patient outcomes first. And you know, what humans can do better, we'll do better until we can't.
I mean, just think about when you're operating, you're doing your routine cataract, and you're obviously in your mind always cognizant of where is the capsule. But it's a clear tissue that we have a hard time visualizing exactly through the scope. And as you know, for human eyes, 30 frames a second, even 25 frames a second seems pretty fluid to us. So what if you could have a robotic system that had, let's say, a built-in OCT that could visualize that capsule at 10 times that rate?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
the refresh rate's crazy. But here's the other kicker, too. We always think that machines have to, well, we don't always, but a lot of folks think that machines have to see things the way humans see things. So instead of using a microscope with, you know, visible light spectrum light, we could be using infrared, we could be using B-scan, we could be using all these
OCT,
different...
right?
Yeah, OCT, different methodologies to highlight these very delicate structures. There are some companies coming out with some, you know, advancements in that visualization, but to be sure, machines are able to break down information in ways that humans are not able to, and vice versa too. So,
right.
You know, but
we've got our own amazing computers between our ears, right?
Our organic, I mean, people can knock Neuralink from, you know, Elon, but I personally think that's going to be, if you can somehow enhance our organic computers, that's really the only way we're going to be able to compete with supercomputers in the future. So Neuralink is going to give, you know, straight AI run for its money, I think.
I think, but before that happens, I'm going to be retired on my little love. Vacation house somewhere, just like no internet connection, don't bother me.
Yeah, I'd love to come visit. Maybe hide out when the machines take over.
So let's finish brainstorming this. The last part here. Okay, we've talked about I think that we shouldn't collapse the bag. We talked about maybe there'll be a magical drop that'll stop the cataracts. Obviously, we want to have accommodation. What else could we be doing differently for our future cataract surgeries? We'll look back on and say, "Why I used to do it that way?"
So this is a great exercise because I've gone step by step to think about what we can improve on. And sure. For me, I like to decrease variation. When you decrease variation in a system and the noise, you improve the data that comes back, and then you could say, this is how we can improve outcomes. So for me, things like wound creation is a commonly overlooked thing. I know actually cataractcoach.com has a great video on, you know, none of this like tri-bevel, it's, you know, a uniplanar, the right direction, square, good,
the right
good amount of, yeah, the architecture that allows for that. So, but how do we reproduce that over and over and over again? And so maybe offline we can chat about this, but thinking about the steps of cataract surgery, from the incisions that we make to the capsulotomies, because that has reproducibility and, you know, disclosure. I work with companies that multiple companies that do different types of capsulotomies, but if you can make it more uniform, standardize it, then you know that the outcome is going to depend more on the variables that are not controlled. So if you can control capsulotomy, yeah, it's exactly. It's out of an outcome, you can't say, well, it's because I made the incision pretty anterior this time, right?
Right.
So thinking about each step of a cataract surgery, if we just look at our own, we say, how is this automated? How is this reproducible? That's why there's a lot of arguments for spending the extra money on products that can really give you consistent results and then narrow down the differences between patients and say, this is what is actually important. There are going to be formulas in 5 years that hopefully point something out that we weren't measuring. What is it like? Choroidal thickness, whatever it is, right? Like something that we don't have in our current generation formulas that will give us better predictive measures. That coupled with more forgiving lenses, but the more we can control each step, I think, is the way we should think about decreasing the noise and improving our results.
Absolutely. And in fact, for the lens calc stuff, I'm already involved in another project, another disclosure, which is iolcalc.com, which is John Lattice and the Lattice Super Formula, which is now fully AI-based. And no doubt about it, I can take your average surgeon from probably 70 to 80% accuracy, which is plus or minus half diopter, and bring you to at least 90. And we've even looked at data sets from really huge name ophthalmologists who've been previous podcast guests who've given us data. And these guys are already geniuses of lens calcs. We made them even better. And I think this is just the beginning. It's going to only keep getting better and better and better as we collect more of this big group data. I think one of the neat things now is to have the group data. And just going about lens calcs, I mean, talk about, okay, we should hone the A constant, which is an antiquated idea even when it came out decades ago, because that raises all eyes or lowers all eyes. And do you really want to treat that little tiny hyperopic guy like the big myopic guy? No, you probably don't. And yeah. So to be able to hone, instead of one A constant, let's say a 10 by 10 by 10 grid of 1,000 points, 10 ranges of AC depth, 10 ranges of axial length, 10 ranges of K, and hone 1,000 points. That's what we do. Lattice Performance is honing 1,000 points, not one A constant.
That's, I mean, it all is spurred by not being content with the status quo, right?
Right.
Today's formulas were really impressive 10 years ago.
Right.
They're less impressive, and it's, you know, folks like you working on those types of things really push us forward because we're saying, yeah, you know, 95%, not great enough. I mean, when I was a resident, a 20/40 or better target after cataract surgery was like, yeah, mission accomplished, you know, land on an aircraft here. It's a little bit different now, right? Like we say 20/40, what happened? Get an OCT,
right.
Let's figure this out. What's the refraction? So, but it's that perfection for our patients.
Right.
You know, the sleepless nights, not because it all comes back to how do we get better results for our patients.
No, for sure. I think that's the smart thing you said early on, is like, just always put the patient first, and then you can't go wrong. You'll obviously want to innovate in that direction.
Yeah. You want to make it better next year than this year for that person.
All right, now I got to ask. I've been enjoying this podcast with you, and I see two pictures on the wall. I see Ben Franklin and some sort of cartoon character that I kind of recognize but kind of don't. You got to tell me.
Yeah, so I'll start with this guy. That's Beaker. I don't know if you remember Beaker from the Muppets. He's a scientist who finds himself in all sorts of precarious situations with fires blowing up in the lab and glasses exploding. But you know, he's my spirit animal when I think about my research. It's the trials and tribulations. So my wife got me that for Christmas 1 year, and this is a pretty new addition. I actually had a pretty trippy squid up there, a psychedelic squid, but this I just got printed. It was a drawing. I got a buddy in India who's a graphic artist, and I asked him to, you know, commission a piece of work. I said Ben Franklin is a personal hero, you know, when you think about the different founding fathers, who do you connect with? This guy is one of my heroes in life. So I asked him if he could come up with a cool sketch, and he did, and put it on some canvas and found a frame that was going to be thrown away in the trash can, and I pulled it out and it fit perfectly. So
awesome. Now what's the connection? How does Ben Franklin resonate with you?
Well, he loved philosophy, number one. I think he read a lot of books and understood how people thought through the ages and how similar we were. He was a prudent guy. He thought through a lot of situations calmly, was a great businessman. And most of all, he's a stellar inventor. I mean, he's done tons for America, from, you know, saving a bunch of people's houses from fire, from lightning, you know, with the invention that you could put a, you know, lightning rod on the house and ground it rather than have it go through the house, to the first fire department actually in Philadelphia, and saving numerous folks from that, just from an idea of saying, hey, let's create a center where people can leave from with machines that can fight fires. That's like a very reasonable thing, but nobody had thought about it. So, but if you're ever in Philly, if you go to the Franklin Institute, it's a science museum, you could see a bunch of his stuff. He created batteries, he created all these things. Just a guy way ahead of his time. He's like an American Da Vinci.
I love it. I love that connection. That's a good way of putting it, an American Da Vinci.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I see a lot of that with what you're talking about in you. You're starting to innovate these things. The nice part is you're just the beginning of your career. I can't wait to see where you're going to be in 10 or 20 years. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, nowhere close to him, but I can, you know, a guy can dream, but yeah, he's a person that we should all learn about. But I appreciate you saying that. Still striving for figuring out new things, just like you, and pushing the field forward.
Absolutely. So let's wrap this up with some great advice for the young ophthalmologists. We have a lot of young ophthalmologists, a lot of residents, even some med students, residents, mm-hmm. fellows, some early years of practice who listen to the podcast. What advice can we tell them? We've given them a lot of advice over the previous 20 podcasts, let's say, but what can you offer here? What did you learn the hard way?
Yeah, two main points. The first point is, and I think you remember this from the ACOS mentorship session, but there's a running joke that doctors don't make good business people. And I want to set the record straight. Physicians can learn anything better than almost anybody else on this planet.
Right.
And we are fast learners. Medical school is so tough. If you can do that and absorb all that, you can learn simple business skills that'll keep you sharp. And it doesn't have to be that complicated, but just understanding the type of business skills that'll give you knowledge so that you can make good decisions for the practices you join, asking for transparency, seeing where the money goes, that sort of thing, so you don't get taken advantage of. Because everybody always tells you, let the other folks, the administrators, take care of the business. You focus on patients, you stay in the exam lane. Well, they've said that for the last 30 years. Administrators have grown by like 3,000%, physicians, flatline. We're doing more administrative stuff today than we had 30 years ago.
Right.
What do we pay them to do? So the joke's on us. We pay for administrator salaries without actually getting the benefit of them taking care of all the administrative tasks. So I would say learn some very basic business skills for practice management so that you can be part of the conversation. You don't have to be, you know, the sharpest starting your own startups and whatnot, but that's a different conversation, what that would be, what the curriculum is. And I'd love to, you know, if people are interested, we're trying to put something together for that, like a crash course. And then the second thing is find a place. If you don't know what you love yet, or you want to explore, you have to find environments that are just throwing opportunities your way. Where
like,
people
what do you
say,
mean?
So I mean, like, if you are a medical student, you should go to a residency that gives you opportunities that open doors before you even know what you want to do. So it's hard enough to get into residency, so that's just the top, type of goal. But if you have an inkling of what you want to do, whether it's, oh, I want to do, you know, product development, or I want to just do really good clinical work, you got to find the mentors at those places and get the opportunities to interact with people that'll teach you. In residency, you have to think about fellowship in that way. And in fellowship, we don't always know what we want to do when we grow up. And we're still trying to figure it out, right? We're, you know, I'm sure you're trying new things out, and so am I, and saying, do I like this or not? But until you really hone in on what you love to do, you need to be in a place that can give you those opportunities, and it doesn't have to be on your home turf. You can reach out to people now and say, hi, I'd like to get involved with your research, your type of research, because that's what I think I want to do later on. And you have to do it well. You're not going to get a good reputation if you take on something and you do a crappy job at it. So make sure you have the time commitment. But just trying stuff and then knowing whether you like it or not, and then pivoting. You don't have to keep doing it, but doing that is really important for your first 5 to 10 years, I think, out of practice, out of training.
Wow, those are some really great pearls. Yeah, I mean, as a medical student, medical school is intense.
Yeah.
Especially now. It was easier when I did it. There was less knowledge to know in the same 4 years. Now you've got to learn so much more.
Yeah.
But at the same time, so you're obviously a fantastic learner already. If you went to medical school, you know how to learn, and you can teach yourself anything. I totally agree with you. That's like, wow, those are such great pearls. And then ability to pivot, or like I say, change gears. It's okay. Give yourself permission. If you're doing something and it's not quite your flavor, pivot to something else. Change the gears.
Absolutely right. I'm shocked at how many young people think that they're locked into something. And it's like,
you're
even if you lived for another year, wouldn't you rather have pivoted? And if you live for another 50 years, you're getting on the right track now, you know, to worry.
Yeah.
I want my dad to get his college degree, and he's, you know, in his 70s. He thinks it's a little silly, and I'm thinking, why not? It's never too late to start, you know, afresh. And I think there's a German philosopher who said something like, a man, this is old time, so a man or a woman now, but a man, even with his last breath, can start anew. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know,
it's true.
It just means you can have a fresh start, or you can do something different than what you're doing. You are not trapped. We just get pressured into thinking we have this, like, and then I have to do this, and then I have to do that. And the least happy I've ever been in my life is when I had that mentality. where I wasn't thinking about being able to pivot.
Yeah, for sure.
You know?
For sure, when you feel like you're locked in, that's the worst.
Locked in, or you put too much effort into something, and it's, you know, spend your energy on the stuff that you think is going to make you learn more, be happier in the long term.
Oh, that is such great advice. Yeah, and then remember, the pivoting and the gear changing is not a one-time thing, or even two. It's actually throughout your career. I am doing it now. Stopping resident teaching and now doing more in projects or whatever. And the other thing, you had a great point too, is it's never too late. Like, I started cataract coach in my like late 40s. And I was like, you know how I started it? One video at a time. And this October will be 2,000 days in a row.
That's so crazy. Like, when you told me you do like a video a day, it's like... It's
every day.
That's crazy. The amount of love and energy put into it. I mean, it pays huge dividends. I mean, I've talked to people all around the world who watch it, you know, and have gained a lot from it. So what you've contributed to the community is really unmatched from an education standpoint.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored. It's almost selfish. I learn so much by doing it. I get 5 to 10 videos sent to me every day. I watch every one of them. So the sad part is I don't actually watch Netflix or Amazon or HBO. I actually watch probably 30 to 60 minutes of iVideos a day.
Yeah, that's you're the cloud. That's where people are sending their videos, to the cloud. You're the cloud. You're the all-knowing cataract coach.
No, we're continuing. Wow, what an incredible conversation. I learned so much from you. I'm going to post the question here for our viewers to reply in the comment section below. What is it that 25, 30 years from now we'll look back and say, whoa, why would you do that for cataract surgery? Think about it. Please, to all our viewers, leave us a comment below. We're going to read every comment. Let's get some collective brains together. We've got thousands of people who are going to hear and watch this podcast. So put all our brains together. I want a list of what do you think we'll look back on and say, you know, we should have done something differently. And then when That'll I'm 20 years from now, when I'm retiring, we'll look back and say, who was right? I'll give you a prize.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Christos. I really enjoyed this conversation. You are an incredible, bright, shining star in the ophthalmology space. I'm looking forward to just tracking, following your career, and seeing what kind of Ben Franklin things and sometimes crazy scientist things you bring to the future.
Thanks, Uday. Well, you know, it's mentors and friends like you that have, through the last few years, have really motivated me to keep going. So it means a lot to be invited. It's an honor. And keep doing what you're doing, because you're helping thousands and thousands of surgeons. So I'm just glad I could be a small part of it.
Thank you so much. And I want to remind our audience, remember, new podcast every single Sunday on here, YouTube, on Cataract Coach, on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, wherever you find your podcast, every Sunday. Check it out. Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me and Christos Ifantidis. What an amazing young ophthalmologist. We're going to see more and more of him on the podium and in the development of products in our field. And I hope that you got some great pearls that you can apply to your own daily life and to improve your own practice. Please remember to send me an email or a note. Let me know who would you like to have as the next guest. You can even leave a comment below in the video. And we'll get those arranged for you in the next few episodes.